get to know you. We're going to talk it out. We're going to get to know you and what you're all about. We're going to get to know just what makes you feel alive. We're going to get to know how you build, lead, and thrive.
Build, Lead, and Thrive. Voices of the Androscoggin.
Welcome to Build, Lead, Thrive, Voices of Androscoggin, a bi-monthly podcast that features in-depth conversations with the people shaping Androscoggin County. Each episode dives into personal stories, showcasing the leaders and entrepreneurs behind the region's economic and community vitality. Hi, I'm your host, Shanna Cox, President and CEO of the LA Metro Chamber. I'm joined by longtime friend, a local talent, and our producer, Mr. Mark Turcotte.
How you doing?
Editing that in.
I'm going to make it sound
seamless.
He's going
to pull that from a different episode is what he's going to do. Hi, Shanna. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Shanna.
How are you?
I'm doing swimmingly.
Thanks
How are you?
Thanks for being back.
Thanks for having me back.
Congratulations on our 1 year anniversary.
I know, right?
It's just exciting.
Who'd have thunk it?
I prayed for it.
You hoped for it. When we first started, people didn't give us a month. And here we are, a year later.
It's incredible, our progress. It's incredible. Yeah. Today, we get to celebrate that with our special guests. So we're joined by Meg Hatch. She's our executive director at the Sexual Assault Prevention and Response Services. Folks around here just refer to it as SAPRS, serving Androscoggin, Oxford, and Franklin counties. Meg has spent nearly two decades in the field of sexual violence prevention and response and is known for leading with honesty, compassion, and my favorite part, real-world practicality. So, welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Really happy to be here.
Thanks. You apparently in our anniversary episode, so.
I'm sorry I didn't bring you a gift.
We'll let you sing a song later. Okay. That would be a gift. We have a long history of bad singing on this show, so I hope that you don't disrupt that by sounding good in any way.
I won't.
Thank goodness. Before we jump in, make sure you guys take a second to follow or subscribe wherever you're listening. It really helps others discover these local stories and make sure that you don't miss an episode. So, let's talk a little bit about Meg. Meg, I'm going to sing your song for a second. You get just to sit there and, you know, blush or squirm or whatever might come your way. Meg's the executive director of SAPRS, which is a nonprofit that's been supporting survivors and educating communities for more than 40 years. In her role, Meg oversees strategy, programs, and people, ensuring that SAPRS continues to meet its mission of providing compassionate services to survivors, delivering prevention education, and advocating for systemic change. In fact, you spend a lot of time in systems work.
I have.
I love that. I think fundamentally I just embrace systems work and folks who can work on and within systems while still like moving to action and executing in day-to-day work. And that's a rare blend and one of my favorite things about you.
Yeah, it can be rewarding and frustrating.
Yeah.
as I'm sure you can imagine.
It's two sides of the same coin,
yeah.
Right? Like if you're
100%.
Yeah, if you're putting any of that in the bank, it's definitely coming with both. No, that's been my experience too. So nearly two decades of experience in Maine's sexual violence prevention and response field have spanned literally every level of this work. So from frontline advocacy to organizational leadership. Meg's career includes serving as the Associate Dean of the Student Experience and Title IX Coordinator at Colby College, leading the Children's Advocacy Center Network at the Maine Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and working as a forensic interviewer, a program manager, and a prevention educator. It's kind of like you've done everything.
Kind of, yeah.
I think that's what makes great leadership, though.
It's very helpful in being the executive director of an organization where you've actually done the roles.
Yeah.
I think that it gives you a lot of credibility for the people that you're working with. And I think it provides you with sort of a deep level of empathy around what it's actually like to be the person on the ground doing that job.
I know from having talked to your colleagues that they actually, like, that is all 100% true. That's, I think, what they really respond to in your leadership and really respect and appreciate about you and feel respected and honored in their own role. So I would just say there's no think in that statement.
Yeah.
I know that that is absolutely
true.
Yeah, well, I just
thank you for validating.
Yeah, I mean, I am just the messenger. It is your team that has validated that. And I think that's the most, like, that's where in my world, in my own experience, validation means the most when it comes from those.
The people that you're leading.
Yeah, it's exactly that. So your leadership has been informed by your educational journey. So Meg earned her bachelor's in liberal studies from the University of Maine at Augusta. She is nearly complete her master's in higher education administration from the University of Southern Maine. Your foundation in education and leadership, as we're talking about, complements your hands-on experience and reinforces your commitment to building safer, more responsive systems. That's what I'm hearing in the administration. Like, that's systems work, right? And you model authentic trauma-informed leadership.
I try to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know you're doing it well when you say something like, I try to, right? Because people who aren't trying to and aren't humble just are like, yes, of course, you're welcome.
Obviously. Obviously, that's how I'm operating.
Yeah. Yeah. You've always struck me as super authentic. I think anyone sits with you for a minute, they realize that almost immediately. And that's, I can see why your career spans all that it does. Because I think when you're showing up with that, it just makes it easier to bring people together to work in coalitions and to lead.
Yeah.
Right?
100%. I mean, I think I'm thinking about, in particular, the work that I did at the Maine Coalition Against Sexual Assault when we were working on developing children's advocacy centers across the state. So when I started, there were two. There was one here in Lewiston, and there was one in Waterville. And now we have CACs for every jurisdiction, every prosecutorial jurisdiction in the state. So every child in Maine now has access to a children's advocacy center. But in doing that multidisciplinary teamwork, you know, you're working with cops, CPS caseworkers, prosecutors, medical providers, mental health providers, people who see through the bullshit, right?
Yeah.
So you have to show up authentically. Otherwise, you can't build trust and you can't build a program. You know, and I think that CAC programs are built on a foundation of trust.
Yeah.
And if you don't have that foundation of trust, you don't have a children's advocacy center.
Yeah. Well, and one step further, if the folks who conceived it and are responsible for responding and coordinating and like doing the work of the center aren't seeing the importance of trust and the foundation of trust, that's going to relay into their support with families. And so like you have to build that foundation from trust from the ground up.
Yeah.
You must be so proud of that work.
I am. It's one of the things that I'm most proud of.
Yeah.
In my
like that's a like legacy.
In my professional path.
That's transformative for families across the entire state and will be forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Were you a Girl Scout?
No.
But I'm a Girl Scout. That's a Girl Scout.
But
credo.
I do, you know, I do a lot of outdoor stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, like leave no trace and you know, leave your campsite.
Leave it better than you found
better than you found
I'm
it.
I'm a camper.
So, yeah.
When we talk to your peers and your coworkers and your team, some of what comes up is that you are known for honesty, humor, and humanity, which you're already obviously displaying, but that you bring compassion to difficult conversations and courage to complex systems, which I loved some of those comments. I would put a footnote in that outside of work, you find joy in Maine's natural beauty, in a good book, in cooking and sharing meals, and in time with the people that you love.
All true.
You're just like a real human. It's always a good reminder for folks. I try to highlight that. I think sometimes, particularly organizational leaders or folks who have done like big systems work, from the outside looking in, we just get caught up as titles or a series of assumptions. And
yeah,
it's just really nice to remind folks that you're like the whole human.
I'm just a person,
right?
You know, and I think, having had some of the experiences that I've had, like talking to legislators or going to Washington, D.C. and meeting with our delegation and like having those conversations with, you know, people in positions of significant power demonstrates that they're just people, too.
That's the fundamental
thing. They're just people, too.
I think that's the thing that keeps me calm in a lot of situations is like I've had weird intersections in spheres of influence and power. And when you're not brought into that room where the power dynamic is part of what you have to consider, you're like, I've been a consultant, and so I've been in those spaces in a way that like I was invited in and it was very normalized. You're not, you know, asking for somebody to use their position of power to like vote on the bill or something. But when you've been in enough of those rooms, you realize like we are all actually just people, and it really can help level set some of the conversations that I know some people get kind of knotted up about.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, they're trying to figure out their day, same as the rest of us.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Before we dig in, we always like to open with a little segment called Getting to Know You. A couple of short questions, short answers.
Love it.
When you need to truly recharge, what is your go-to ritual?
Doing something outside. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite things to do is like go hike a mountain, go mm-hmm. spend some time in the woods, or going to the beach. The beach, the ocean always is a reset for me.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, it's get the f*** outside.
Are you like a 4,000 footer kind of gal? Or are we like, give me a board done, work and some level?
I have done most of the 4,000 footers.
Yeah, I thought that might be the case.
So I do like to, you know, I like to do a hike. Are and you? my dog reluctantly joins
What kind of dog is it?
She's a mutt, but she kind of looks like a Rhodesian Ridgeback.
Oh, yeah.
But man, she really just wants to be on the couch.
What is one small joy or habit that you make time for even on your busiest weeks? Something that just helps you stay grounded?
I would probably say staying connected. I have this incredible network of girlfriends.
Mm.
And so I think it's about reaching out and connecting. And that always, it always makes me feel better.
Yeah. Do you do it with a group chat or are you trying to manage a whole bunch of different connections?
It depends, right? Because it's like people from different parts of my life.
Yeah.
And I actually, at the end of September this year, gathered everyone together so people could...
You brought all stages of your life friends together?
Oh my God. It was so good. I highly recommend it.
That is definitely just moved up on my priority list.
It was really awesome. And like since then, a couple of folks have like gotten together and had lunch or gone out for coffee. And so like it just brought me so much joy to like bring those people together. And now there's new connections.
That's fantastic. Yeah. What's your favorite way to spend a day off here in Androscoggin County?
I love downtown Lewiston.
Yeah.
I had not spent a lot of time in this part of the state before I came here for work. And so I've had, you know, a little over 2.5 years here. I love all the restaurants downtown. I love Baxter. I love El Pocho's.
Yeah.
Da Vinci's. There's so many great places to eat.
Yeah.
It just feels like downtown just feels like there's like something magical that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And that feels really exciting to watch.
I love that. Here's my last one. What's something that always makes you laugh, no matter what's going on?
Dad jokes.
Yeah.
I am a sucker for dad jokes and I torture my staff with them. I think they like it though. They laugh sometimes.
Good.
But I mean some of them are just so
any dad joke, good pun, and by good pun I mean it's awful.
Yes.
It's gotta be awful
Same.
To be. Mark, how about you? You wanna weigh in on this one?
I love dad jokes.
Dad
as
jokes
well.
And good bad puns.
Yeah. I wrote one recently. I have a new character I'm doing on stage that does one-liners.
Let's hear it.
And I have one for you guys.
Share it.
I love this.
I lost a lot of weight while learning how to talk to dead people. Now I'm a medium.
Yep. That checks all the boxes.
Well done.
There's a good pun in there.
I have another one.
Let's hear it.
Oh, I'm just going to keep going. No.
That's okay. That would be the best.
I love a good dad joke.
Right? Archaeologists in Boston are very close to locating the outhouse of Paul Revere. They found a number one by land and a number two by sea.
My dad Vernon, I hope, is listening to this particular podcast. And I can tell you, he literally slapped his knee. I can see it in my mind's eye.
I'm going to stop now.
It's so good.
So good.
I love
so
a good dad joke.
Yeah.
And I like, I'm ridiculous with them. It's
same.
I respect that so much.
Yeah.
They do love it. Or at least we tell ourselves and them. I tell my team, like, you know you love this.
Yeah. Yeah. Same thing with like, we've my associate director and I, Shauna, have been really intentional about sort of doing some relationship building with staff. And so essentially just having them do icebreakers at the beginning of any staff meeting. And like, you know, when you say the word icebreaker, people roll their eyes and they think it's going to be awful. But like now I almost think they look forward to like, what questions are we going to get to answer this time around? And it has been so fun and interesting.
I love that.
To learn just weird little facts about the people that you spend so much time working with.
Yeah, I think that we spend so much time in areas of like alignment and focus relative to our work.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes there's like stuff on the edges that we get to like your dog, car repairs, and, you know, but there's just some really cool historical core things sometimes that you just don't get a chance to. You have to make it intentional. And I love that you're making it intentional. Yeah. All right, so we met the human being behind the role. Let's talk about how you build. Thinking back to your early days, what were the essential building blocks, whether they're skills, relationships, mentors, something else that shaped your path? What helped build you?
So many things.
Yeah.
So many things. I think, you know, early on, definitely I had some mentors. Mm-hmm. I think about when I was in eighth grade, I had this wonderful music teacher. I was a tuba player.
Oh, hey, now.
And actually, that's what I did right after college was I went to Conservatory of Music as a tuba player. I thought I wanted to be a performance major and then get my master's and be a music teacher. That's what I thought I wanted to do. But that's not what I wanted to do, turns out. So I took a different path. But I think about, like, people. It's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And on both sides of that, right? Like, having really excellent leadership mm-hmm. and having really leadership.
Yeah.
And knowing, like, I don't ever want to be that uh-huh. person. But, wow, I really like those things that this person is doing. So I think having examples.
Yeah.
is really helpful.
Yeah.
And then having people give me opportunities that, like, I really didn't deserve,
you know, or maybe you deserved but hadn't thought about for yourself.
Well, yeah, I mean,
do you really, like, think you weren't deserving?
Okay, so I'm going to tell you a story. It's going to take a little bit,
but I love
this is going to demonstrate this. So, when I first got into this work, so at the time I was a massage therapist part-time and a baker part-time. And I met someone who was the executive director of a different sexual assault center. And we talked, and we were at a 4th of July party, and we talked about maybe doing some sort of support group where we taught people how to do some self-massage techniques
yeah.
for relaxation. And so we were all excited about it, but then, you know, like, a year goes by, we're back at the same party again, and we're having this same conversation again, and some things were happening at the chiropractic clinic that I was working at insurance-wise, and so things were going to change for me in a little bit. And so I sort of said to this person, like, well, you don't happen to be hiring at your center. And she was like, well, I'm not, but the person who runs the Waterville Center, I think, might be. So she gave me her name and number, and I literally like cold called her the next day or whenever. And she was like, well, you know, I don't have any open positions right now, but I just wrote a grant. And so please call me back in like 6 weeks. And I was like, all right. And so 2 days later, she called me back and was like, my prevention educator just gave their notice. Is that something you might be interested in? And she was like, why don't you come in and we can talk about it? And I was like, great. So I went in, she described the position, and I was like, yeah, I think I can do that. And mind you, like, I don't have a degree. I don't have really any training. The only thing I know about sexual assault support centers is that I had worked with an advocate because of my own experience.
Yeah.
And she was like, great, well, send in your resume and apply for the job. And so I did. And for some reason, I think it's probably because nobody else applied for it. But I got hired.
I mean, that makes you deserving, right? Like, that makes you... That's a wild story.
Yeah. And I think about that now, and I think, how crazy was I to be like, oh, I'll just call
now
them.
That you're
like,
on the hiring end of things.
So can I have a job? Like, in what world?
The job market was different back in the day.
I mean, I guess it was. Yeah.
That's great, though. Do you still play the tuba?
I do not. It's been a very long time.
I bet you could pick it up.
I probably could.
Yeah.
But
muscle memory for that long must be there.
It's been a while.
Doesn't mean you sound great necessarily. You might be squeaky a little.
I don't want to do it on the podcast.
I'm going to. Oh, well.
It just so happens.
Can you imagine if I was hiding a tuba under
the
table?
We did a deep dive on your Facebook and found that picture of you with a tuba.
And I found a tuba. And I alerted Mark to this. Don't worry, you're safe. I did none of those things today.
Great.
Your face for a second, though. Yeah, could you imagine? Let's just pull that out. When you stepped into your ED role, what were some of the first kind of structural investments that you focused on to help build you in your role and your organization as you took it?
So a couple of things come to mind. Because I believe that, like, relationships are the foundation,
yeah.
right, of a successful organization.
I love that about you, yeah.
One of the first things that I did, and, you know, as staff, who some of whom knew me, just from Maine is a big small town, as you know, and
super.
You know, the sexual assault support center world is quite small, and
yeah.
so people sort of knew me professionally as a colleague,
yeah.
but I think people were still, not everybody, but I think people were still nervous, right?
Because
you never know. When someone gets into a leadership role, they might be a completely different person
yeah.
than when they were a colleague, which
yeah.
I also think is terrible when people do that, but
yeah.
that's a different topic.
Yeah. Wow.
So I wanted to be really intentional about, you know, I met with Shauna before I started, and we had a lovely lunch at Da Vinci's, and we spent like 2 hours together, and she had applied for the job, And so I knew that. And so one of the first things I wanted to talk about with her was like, look, like, I know that you applied for the job, and I just want to, like, give you an opportunity. If you've got things you want to say about that, like, let's talk about it, yeah. Like, before I come to the office. And she said to me, she was like, oh, my God, Meg. She's like, I'm so relieved it's you and not me.
That's and a I good was foundation.
Like, uh-oh. Yeah. But not for it. She was just like, I just don't know that I'm ready yeah. right now. And she had a lot going on in her personal life. And she was like, I'm actually really relieved. And
timing so, matters. Sometimes yeah. timing oh, is sure. the only thing that
for
differentiates.
Sure. Yeah. For sure. And then I really was intentional about setting up a time to meet individually with every yeah. single staff person to be like, tell me about your work. Tell me about what you love about your job. Tell me about what's hard. Tell me about what you're hoping from leadership. Yeah. You know, what would be helpful? What would be most helpful for you? I think that went a long way. Yeah. And then a few months in, we did a staff climate survey, mm-hmm. So that staff could have an opportunity to provide us with anonymous feedback. And that's something that we do on a regular basis. I think that's really important in sort of, again, building that trust, helping people feel heard, allowing people to have an opportunity to sort of create the environment within which they work.
Yeah.
And I think it was just being really intentional about having those icebreakers at the beginning of our meetings, being a little bit foolish, telling bad dad jokes, you know, letting people see me as a full human being, yeah. being transparent when I'm having a bad day or if something happened at home, like feeling like I could, you know, not overshare, but like this is a safe place where I could talk about it.
Yeah.
And so I feel like those were sort of the strategies at the beginning to sort of immediately start trying to build that trust and build those relationships so that then we could get together and do some work around that.
Yeah.
You know, and then I think sort of like practically, maybe a year or so in, we engaged in a organizational development planning process mm-hmm. with a lovely facilitator. And it was very interesting, and I'm sure you know this and probably have had an experience where oftentimes strategic planning processes are confusing and not that great. And I really think a number of my staff people like had some trauma around previous experiences. So I knew that sort of offering that opportunity, and we did board and staff together, which was really fun. Mm-hmm. Initially, I just had to do a lot of reassurance. Like,
yeah.
this is not going to be what you have experienced before, because I know what it's like to go through a process, and then at the end you get a document, and you're like, I don't even know what these things, I don't even know what this means. Yeah. I'm supposed to do what? So we spent 2 days together and went through a process, and at the end, everybody was kind of like, that actually wasn't too bad.
It didn't seem the way I thought it was going to.
And then we went through, we sort of fleshed out our goals and action steps, but with the teams who were going to be working on those goals and action steps. Yeah. And so it was really created by them. So I think I've also really tried to give people the opportunity to take leadership in their yeah. own roles in a way that they didn't have before.
Yeah.
And it's been really cool to see people really like blossom.
Yeah.
And like start solving their own problems. Mm-hmm. And so that's been really satisfying.
And their work as a result of it.
Yeah. And yeah. I think that they just feel more, I'm going to be more invested in a plan if I had some say in the yeah. plan.
If it's my
right?
plan.
If it's
too.
My plan.
It wasn't like handed
it wasn't
to
like,
me.
Here's your plan.
I was making faces and chuckling because before I was in this role, I did strategic planning as like a core service in my consultancy practice. Uh-huh. And so my values, and I wouldn't work with somebody if they didn't share them, wouldn't do a plan that was anything other than something that has some evergreen components and is regularly updated, mm-hmm. doesn't live on a shelf and is regularly used, and has meaningful engagement in its creation. Because, like, it's hard. The resources that it takes to run a planning process like that an organization or a business puts into really putting together a meaningful strategic plan is time and it's money and it's all the things. Like, why do that so you can put a plan on the shelf?
Yeah.
Like, here, I can give you some dusty documents. You can file it. We can just check the box and say it's all done. And we didn't spend any of that.
Exactly.
And so I chuckled because in almost all, like to the last one, rooms that I would walk into to start, whether it was a long process, whether it was a short retreat, but the kickoff was always eye rolls and hesitation and anxiety mm-hmm. because there's so much bad planning yeah. that's done out there. And you can't go through a process and not just deal with that head on.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And having myself been through a couple of processes
right.
where I'm like, what is happening here? Yeah. Like, the facilitator's not making any sense. You're, like, way out of alignment with, like, what our work actually is. Yeah. And it's just, like, such a waste of time.
That. That's, I mean, it's a really, that's a great start for you. How long in were you before you decided to take on a planning process like that?
So I started in July of 23, and we went through that process in September of 24. So a little over a year.
How long was the tenure of your predecessor?
So Sappers has had, they had a founding director who was there for 37 years. And then they had an internal person who was the associate director for a number of years, who then was executive director for about 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. You've worked across advocacy, education, statewide coordination. What have you learned about building systems that actually serve survivors and the people who do the work? Like, what's your learning around system building?
Again,
in a nutshell.
Yeah, I mean, again, and I say this, and I keep saying this, and every time I say it, I'm like, I think this is just the answer, that it's all about relationships.
Yeah.
It's foundationally all about relationships and taking the time to build the trust to make those relationships sustainable.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a place where a lot of times we don't spend the time intentionally because we don't think we have it. But again, it saves you. You know, if you spend 30 minutes doing that, just get to know you as a human being session with somebody.
Makes everything easier.
It makes everything
and quicker,
easier.
And,
right, because they can see you as a person. And that makes collaboration so much easier. But you can't do any of that work. And you can't do systems change if people don't trust you.
Yeah. I love your consistency in your answer, so that's great. But I think it's because it's real, right?
Yeah.
It's authentic. It really is about people and relationships. It's been my experience that a lot of people don't apply that logic or thinking to systems and systems change, right? Like, okay, maybe an organization can be about people. Certainly an interpersonal relationship can be about people. But when you're looking at, like, institutions or systems and you get to those higher levels of change making, policy creation within those spaces, I think oftentimes people really just see it as the system. It's this kind of esoteric, hard thing to... and like in some of the work that I've done, one of the phrases that we would share regularly is humanize the system.
Yep.
If you want to change the system, you have to humanize the system because there are intervention points in the system that are real and they're human based and you have to have the relationships to do it. And I even if it feels redundant to you, I love that that's your answer around a question around building systems because I just don't think the relationship building gets applied to systems nearly enough.
Yeah.
And in every place that I've had any minutia of success in moving a system or intervening in a system, it's always relationships.
Yep.
It's like the first place to think about what the opportunity is.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think particularly when you're thinking about like a system that responds to child abuse, right? Like you keep the kids at the center of that, right? And you can recenter folks when people get sort of off in policy weeds or other weeds. You can bring people back by saying, like, but what we really want to do here is make this system that responds to this specific thing better for kids and their supportive caregivers.
Yeah. How does that show up in your work? It's not easy what you do, particularly if you're not just working at the admin or systems level and you are having a one-on-one conversation with a staff person and something they had to face that day, and those days must come.
Yeah.
How do you sustain yourself or your team?
So we very intentionally talk about taking care of ourselves in practical ways. I have a...
Book a massage.
I have a dear, dear friend who actually is a massage therapist.
Yeah, but I believe in massage.
But
that was not a diss
on
massage.
She also does some very cool other... Her name is Crystal McLean. Her business is Crystal McLean Creative, so shout out to Crystal from Bristol. But
it's easy to remember.
I'll send you a link to her stuff because she does what she calls creative self-care. And it's about teaching people what happens to your brain when you're under stress and why when you're under stress, you literally cannot think in the same way that you think when you're not. And so we've actually had Crystal come and do a couple of workshops for our staff. And that was another place, you know, people were like, I was like, when I sent out the email, I was like, Anne, my friend Crystal is going to come and do a self-care workshop for us. I can feel your eye rolls from here. But again, trust me, like, this is going to be not what you think it's going to be.
Yeah.
And staff talk about her all the time, you know? And so we're really intentional about naming that this work is hard, that vicarious trauma is real, that if you're having a one-on-one with someone and it sounds like maybe this is triggering you in a way, let's explore that and how can we best support you? You know, is this maybe a client where we should have somebody else work with? Like, we try to be flexible around those sorts of things. We also try to be flexible around, like, work hours to a certain extent, right? Like, if you want to start your day at 7:30, great. If you want to start your day at 9, great. If you need to work from home, no problem.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that that's been helpful for staff. It's just, you know, in the nonprofit world, as you know, like, people don't do it for the pay, right? And it's particularly difficult, you know, for organizations like ours, where we rely mostly on federal and state funding. You know, we're trying to sort of build up our unrestricted funds so that we can do more regular raises and keep up with cost of living and all that stuff. But it's hard. And so we really try to think about where else can we be flexible and let people sort of have autonomy over their job. Get your work done, right? Mm-hmm. Like, get your work done. But, like, also, we can be flexible.
Yeah.
We understand that you're a full human. We understand that your job is not the only thing in your life.
Right.
Like, other things are going on. And so I think we just try to be sensitive and just name the thing, you know, like, name it to tame it. You know, I think that's real.
When folks are going through hard times, I think sometimes the narrative that they hear and that other really genuinely well-meaning, like, could be an in-law, could be a family member, let alone coworkers, but it's like, well, you sound really stressed. You should book a massage.
Yeah.
Are you taking care of yourself?
Yeah.
You should, like, there's some one-off solution instead of self-care being, like, a practice that you're supported, that an environment and culture is built around.
Right.
And a massage might absolutely be a key part of that strategy. But, like, booking a solid 90 minutes doesn't somehow eradicate
whatever else is happening in your life. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And
that's
what Crystal teaches, is it's really about
Crystal from Bristol. I'll give her a shout out too. I love that.
Implementing, you know, 30-second strategies, 1-minute strategies, 5-minute strategies that are practical and accessible that you can do, like, literally sitting at your desk.
Yeah.
And it is about, like, genuine self-care,
right?
Is about creating those things and those practices within your life so that when hits the fan, you have some tools in your toolbox and you can go back to them and be like, oh yeah, remember, if I just take 3 deep breaths, that's totally going to reset my nervous system.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to be able to think, and then I'm going to be able to make the next move, and then I'm going to be able to, like, make it through this day.
Talking about it in brain science has been, like, my favorite strategy for getting to, like, the most deeply eye-rolling people who are like, oh, with your hooey-fooey.
Yeah, you want me to take a bubble bath.
Yeah, like, right. And to help people, like, genuinely understand, A, your, like, stress or anxiety has a physical symbols that can help show you what you're going through that you might not be tuned into if you're not careful. But the brain science of it, I think, I have found that to be the best way of having a breakthrough in, like, this larger conversation around self-care or balance or sustaining oneself during kind of, like, hard seasons of work, or, like, you're in it and you know the light is not at the end of the tunnel until 3 months from now.
Yep.
Like, this isn't it's a tough week or I'm overscheduled. You know you're in a season of it. And to help folks really realize, like, this isn't you didn't stiffen up your spine or you're not managing yourself well enough. There's all of these narratives, and women are just as guilty, but I do find that sometimes men are more resistant to hearing that message.
Sure.
And I hate the, I don't know, decades, millennia of gender norms and gender structure that's been placed on that, because like, you have a one-on-one conversation with somebody, and the stresses and the balances and they're there pretty equally for all people.
Yeah.
Which means, like, just having a good tool really does matter.
Yeah. And it also gives people, it's almost like you give them permission to, like, empower themselves in, like, recognizing that you don't have control over the things that are stressing you out.
Yeah.
But you have control over the way that you manage them internally.
Mm-hmm. Your team's lucky. They know that. They know that, but I'm going to lift it up. Your team is lucky.
Thank you.
Just saying.
Thank you.
Just saying. let's focus on leadership. Not that we haven't been, I suppose, but leading in high impact and emotionally demanding work requires both compassion and capacity, which I see from the work and what it demands from you, but I also see you in your work always coming with capacity, and you're like a get done kind of gal, but you never sacrifice compassion in the work that you do and in the way you are getting things done. How, I mean, you've named some of this around your team, but how do you think about that balance of compassion and capacity in the light of the world and the scale of the work that you do and the importance of the work that you do?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Thanks. Take a minute.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of thinking about being compassionate, but also like the work has to get done, mm-hmm. right? And so
it's that
sometimes you have,
and work can sometimes be paralyzing.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I feel that, and my field is not your field.
Yeah,
your field is. I've worked in areas adjacent to your field and had personal experiences that know just like how challenging it is. And so like,
yeah, I mean, I think for me it's about clear and consistent communication, mm-hmm. right? So I think about, like, I'm thinking about this person who we hired, and within the first, like, 2 months, I was like, this isn't going to work out.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you have to be responsible and take, you know, we have to follow our personnel policy and, like, sort of take the steps. And so I was kind of compassionate in relaying the messages to this person, but also had to sort of hold the, and on Tuesday this happened, on Wednesday this happened, on Thursday this happened, and we're not serving the people who we're here to serve in the way that we should be serving them. Yeah. And that's just not acceptable. And so I think you can still like get done, because I do want to get done.
Yeah.
And I've also learned that sometimes it's going to take longer than I want it to.
Oh.
And like, and I just have to I have to learn how to like understand that some people take a little more time in order to sort of make a change or do a thing. And so I think it's about consistency. It's about clarity. Mm. Oftentimes, particularly when you're having to deliver sort of hard news, people tend to use too many words, try to sort of like cushion it in a way when like, it's actually better to just be straightforward.
Yeah.
And you can be straightforward and kind at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think sometimes people feel like that's an impossible, you can't be both of those things, you know, if you're the boss and you have to sort of like lay down the law sometimes.
Yeah.
And that's the case, but I think that you can do it in a way that's kind and compassionate.
Yeah.
You know, unless someone's being a jerk to you, and then in which case put up your boundaries
and
hold firm.
Yeah. Well said. Well said. No, I think that's right. So maybe that was the lesson, but I want to give you the opportunity to like think expansively.
Okay.
What's a leadership lesson you only learned once you were the one making the final call? Because there's so many leadership lessons we learn on our pathway.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some things you really can't learn that lesson meaningfully until you are the one responsible for making the call and you're in the role.
Yep. We have kind of like a leadership team at Sappers, mm-hmm. who I rely on really heavily for making those hard decisions.
Yeah.
And I haven't yet had the experience where the three of us have been in like gridlock or disagreement.
Yeah.
You know, we've been fortunate in that we're able to really talk things through and kind of like get to consensus.
Yeah.
So I think that helps me be able to make those decisions, and it makes it a little bit easier.
Yeah.
Yeah. To make those hard decisions. So I think, again, sharing the power kind of makes having to make hard decisions a little less stressful for me.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to think if there's like a specific lesson. I mean, maybe it's that, like the importance of sharing the power.
I think I would think that feels like a really good candidate. I don't know your life, and I can't say that's the best lesson you've learned or not, but it's a really strong one. Mm-hmm. So many people conceptualize leadership as like you learn on your ascent to a leadership role all the things you'll need to be successful in the role, and then somehow once you get to the role, you no longer need, let alone want to rely on others, share the power, have the input from others. And I think you can make all kinds of projections about what you'd do once you're in that role. I would always rely on other people, or I'd always act independently, or like there's a lot of narrative in our heads about what we attach based on those models of like what we didn't like.
Yep.
And experience, and what we did like and yep. experience. But I think that's just one of those things you can't be sure
yeah.
of what your own style is and what's actually going to work for you until you find yourself in that spot.
Yeah.
So I actually think that's spot on, Meg.
Yeah. I just think about like the windy path that I took to get here. Like I've had a lot of weird jobs. I've done a lot of things.
I'm really still excited about the tuba, and I'm not done trying to scheme on that, but go on. It's a good path.
Yeah. And I think that again, it's back to this, like, we're all just people trying to do a thing, you know? And I think you're right about sort of this, we have this sort of like concept of like, what's a real leader, you know, that sort of comes from all these different places. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, one of the things that I do frequently is say, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I don't feel bad about
no.
it because how could I possibly know everything? Mm-hmm. Right. And so having that humility, right. Like being able to say like, I don't know.
Yeah.
But let's figure it out together.
Yeah. I you know, and that I think question. My, I don't know though.
Yeah, I don't know though, right? And I think, you know, my approach has been and I think this is again something that I've learned by watching people do things that I like and watching people do things that I don't like, that I might have a title, but like we are this organization and all of your voices matter and all of you can take leadership in your own roles and with each other. And so we're all kind of leading each other, even though sometimes like, I'm the person that has to sign the thing.
Right.
Like I got to sign the contract.
Yeah. But a lot of that happening. I feel
like,
that.
Yeah. But like, you know, we're in this together.
Yeah.
And so I need your help as much as you need mine.
I would posit, I would even project onto you my guess of what you might think about this, but I very much share those values, that culture that is our work here. And that's how we approach it. What I find is that like my kind of my internal like mantra and kind of filter that I run things through is if it's positive, it was the team. And if it's critical, I take that one.
Yep.
Right. And so like,
100%.
Right? So like, yes, it's definitely full team. It's all voices in. It's we'll reach that decision together. But if something doesn't work out,
right,
I take and
yes.
And that's like part of that culture, which sounds a little like dissonance because like everything's about the whole team except failures.
Yeah.
In which case I mean, it's not that I'm not holding folks accountable.
Sure.
Right? But if there's I'm in the boardroom and they're like, page 4 has an error on it. I'm like, that's my error. Me. Thank you so much.
Yeah, yeah. Totally.
And they're like, totally. The last event was amazing. And I'm like, this team is incredible.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah. Always. It's whenever there's something nice said, I am always making sure that the person who actually made the thing happen is getting the credit for it. Because I've worked for somebody who never did that.
Yeah.
And who, in fact, took credit for things that they didn't do. And it's like, how?
Yuck. Just how? Just gross.
How can you do that? Yeah. And so being really intentional about when people say nice things to be like, or I get an email from, you know, a nurse at the hospital who says, so-and-so advocate was here last night with my patient and she was so wonderful and we're so lucky to have her. Like, I am definitely sending that to like everybody.
Everybody.
Be like, hey, shout out to so-and-so. Like, keep up the great work.
Yeah.
Because I just think that's so, so important. But again, when things go, when someone's got something that's, you know, not positive feedback,
yeah,
that's on me.
Yeah.
Even if it is my staff person, right? Like
totally. We're
not supporting them appropriately or they didn't get the training that they needed or there's a disconnect here. So I will own that and then hold them accountable if that's what needs to happen.
Yeah.
For sure.
I pegged you for that.
Yeah.
I was pretty sure that was the
good
case.
Call.
I don't know if there's a way to have these values, share that kind of, you know, ethos on how to lead and what being a leader means and somehow, I don't know, be 100% in on like, and if something went wrong, it's everybody's. Like, I just feels like on paper, it feels like those two should not come together. And yet I don't know anyone who I align with and who shares those philosophies and don't do it that way.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Yep, I'm thinking about like one of
Have you ever met anybody who's
no.
like, we share the wins and we share the losses and I tell everybody that they screwed up. Like, no, I just can't imagine it.
Yeah, I don't think that creates the culture that we're going for.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? There's got to be a Harvard Business Review out there, research paper that maybe I can dig in and tell me I'm right or wrong on that one.
You're like, see?
I'm confident regardless. I don't need a report. I think we're doing great.
Yeah, I mean, we have lived experience. Right. That speaks for something.
Yeah, I think that...
Because I think that that, you know, again, it just builds trust with your team. Like, this person is, they're going to protect me like they said they were going to protect me.
Yeah.
And, like, they're going to take on those sort of... If you can take the icky stuff off of people's plates without overwhelming yourself, obviously. Yeah. But, like, why wouldn't you?
I can't think of a good reason. I know plenty of people who could, though, maybe, because they do it. But they're not in this room.
It's an icky thing for you and an icky thing for you and an icky thing for you.
I heard someone's icky thing. I'm going to give it to you today. I'm all out. Yeah, they're just not here today, whoever those people are. Yeah. They're the ones who taught us all the lessons about who we didn't want to be.
Yeah.
I don't know that it's working for them either. Just saying.
Yeah.
You've done such a great job kind of getting at some of the things I wanted to dig into. Here's a question. Maybe that you could put, like, you've spoken to this a little bit. Maybe you could offer some examples or some more to it. But you've worked across different institutions and I would say different fields within your larger kind of response sector and your, you know, wandering journey to get where you are. Tubas included. What do you think is the most effective or important way, something to keep in mind as you try to align partners around shared outcomes?
Yeah.
So not just internally, right? But like when you're doing that systems work, what feels kind of fundamental to you around how to align like really disparate people with really different language. I think of like some kind of the wonky specific terms that different people use. I mean, you're trying to get them to work across sectors or backgrounds, public, private, all of those pieces. What do you think?
So you've
had great success here.
I think you have to start from a place of curiosity. I think you need to spend the time giving people opportunities to talk about their experience. You have to be a good listener and you have to be able to reflect back what people are saying to you.
Yeah.
We would do this really interesting exercise with multidisciplinary teams when we were first starting the work with like when you're first like, you know who you have to bring to the table.
Yeah.
But then you sort of do an exercise where you get people to kind of like talk through, all right, currently if a report of child sexual abuse comes into DHHS or law enforcement, talk us through your case process. And it's super messy.
Yeah.
And it always is. Yeah. And then you can pose questions like, you know, at what point did the caregiver get connected with someone who could support them? Oftentimes the answer
And then
was,
you let it hang.
Never, right?
Right.
And so you sort of like pose these questions about like how, that essentially get at like, how could we be doing this better?
Yeah.
And then you can sort of introduce, like, thank you for going through that exercise with me. These cases are always really complicated and messy. That's just the nature of this work. Yeah. Let me show you what it could look like if you had a CAC in your area. And then you sort of open them up to the possibility that maybe there's a better way to do this. And I think, you know, at that point in time, like, every other state in the country is using this model. So, like, let's get on board here.
Yeah.
And then I think using peer-to-peer education, right? Like, I had a lieutenant from the state police who he and I traveled up to the county several times, down to Calais several times, and he was such an advocate for the model that he could convince any other law enforcement detective in the state that like, oh, well, if this guy says it's all right, then maybe we could, and you do that, you know, if you have a super resistant prosecutor or a super resistant CPS, program administrator, you connect him with somebody who believes in the program and you say like, I'm going to let this person explain to you how this is going to make your job easier.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, just to put a fine point on it, that last piece is in my mind, just like, I think it's so inherent and integrated into your work, but I just want to call it out for our listeners. The being able to name what's in it for you.
What's the benefit
to you? Like, it just, I mean, the best person to deliver that message is somebody with credibility who is, you know, most kind of resembles in whatever ways, like, comes from the same sector, speaks the same language and understands. But it just, like, I think sometimes in the nonprofit sector, the notion that, like, the thing that we're trying to do is a good enough reason. Yeah. That I don't have to explain why it'll make your work easier or your day smoother or your paperwork lighter, like, because it's the feeding people is the right thing to, like, and there are really virtuous missions. There are really good reasons that we should get together or do the thing or start the initiative or create the coalition. If you can't also answer, like, both have to be there. Yeah, don't, yeah. You can't have a crappy organizing reason or principle to get people excited around the outcome.
Yeah.
But, like, you have to be able to say, this is going to take more work. Like, whatever I'm trying to get you to align on is going to ask more from you before you get all of the benefits of it. So I better be able to tell you what they are.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
You just threw it in as a footnote. But for me, it's a really, I think sometimes... And I love the nonprofit sector. I've got years in the nonprofit sector, but I think sometimes in the nonprofit sector, we kind of, like, because it's the right thing to do, feels like it should be enough of an answer.
Right.
And it can't be.
And it can't be.
It can't be.
Right. And I think also...
This is where you excel.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you excel in lots of places, but you always nail this part.
I try to.
Well, but that's my
because
point.
Because I think, right, if I come in and say...
It's the trying that really sets you apart,
Let's change how we're doing it.
Yeah.
Like, right? Like, let's change how we're doing this really complicated thing.
Yeah.
What people hear is, we're doing a bad job.
Yeah. And you want me to do more work to maybe do the same job. You haven't really told me how it's going to be better.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
But I think, yeah, you have to be able to show them, like, this is not only... We're not even doing the right things because it's better for kids and families.
Yeah.
Right?
Though that matters, for
because
sure.
Because that matters, but it's also going to make your job easier because we're eliminating all of... We're going to do all the coordination. We're going to deal with that caregiver who's having the worst day of their life.
Yeah.
We can spend 30 minutes on the phone with them.
Yeah.
I know that you don't have that as a detective.
Right.
Or as a CPS caseworker.
Yeah.
So being able to sort of say, like, here's how it's going to make it easier for you. But I was also thinking about the sort of... A different scenario, but I think one that kind of frustrates people around nonprofits is people coming in with the big ideas, you know, the sort of like visionary folks that don't spend the time doing the like...
Oh, yeah.
You know.
My mental movie screen is just like headshots rolling through right now.
I'm thinking of one person in particular, too, where it was like, holy moly, like, how did you get to this job? Like, who has been doing your job?
It is impressive the way sometimes the competence is not actually the most important defining feature for advancement.
For real.
Wild. Mm-hmm. It's wild to me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I mean, I think vision is important.
Yes.
Like, vision is important. It gets people fired up and it keeps them committed. And, you know, knowing what you're, I always refer to it as the North Star. Like, we'll organize around the North Star.
Yep.
And, like, there's, you know, the trails might get weird or the pass might be snowed in and we gotta, but, like, the North Star, we're always going in the right direction. That can be really key to folks. But if you can't,
how are you going to get there and how it's going to make it better for you?
Like a little bit, or your plan to get clear on that plan. At least. Like just naming, like, I know we need an implementation
plan. But we're
plan.
Not there yet, yeah.
Yeah, something.
Yeah.
Yeah. So not just me, huh? You've had that experience.
Yeah.
But like, on your face as you said it, I was like, oh, she's lived. That is not a story she's been told.
No, that's a lived experience.
That
Thank
is
you
lived
very much.
Experience, 100%. So let's talk about thriving.
I
know. Isn't that
let's talk about thriving.
Yeah. What does thriving look like for you right now, both as a leader but also as a human, when you think about thriving?
Right now at this point in time?
Yeah.
Particular point in time?
Most importantly, exactly at this point in time. Because I think, like, I've had to reassess what thriving looks like for me, I don't know, 4 times over the last 2 years.
Yep.
I don't want to answer the question for you, but I would say that's part of thriving.
Yeah.
Is like taking context clues and your current situation into factor and then like allowing yourself to reassess.
Yep.
So yeah, right now. But specifically, this whole week if you want.
The first word that came to mind was joy.
Yeah.
Right? Like, because there's so much chaos and uncertainty and in a way that none of us have ever experienced.
Yeah.
And it's so easy to go down that drain of everything is terrible.
Yeah.
What, it's just so easy. So I've really been feeling okay about, like, we still got to have some joy here, guys. Yeah. Like, we still, like, there's still good stuff out there, right? Like, there's still good stuff.
Yeah.
And so really trying to be intentional about remembering that. Mm-hmm. I also have been with our staff, you know, I mean, 6 months or so ago, like, we had a very transparent staff meeting where we, as the leadership team, said, we don't know what next year is going to look like.
Yeah.
And so we've run some scenarios of, like, what does it look like if we lose $100,000? What does it look like if we lose $250,000? What does it look like if we lose all of our federal funding, which is like 65 to 70% of our budget? And
does your funding come in part from the Violence for Women's Act?
Some, not right now.
Because that's been super fluid.
But sometimes, that and VOCA, which is the Victim of Crime Act. But VOCA and VAWA are two primary funders of sexual assault and domestic violence centers across the country. And also in that conversation where we sort of said, like, look, here are the scenarios that we've played out, you know, and I was very much like, and, like, if anybody else has ideas, like, we're open to it. Like, these are just three things that we came up with as the leadership team. And none of this is happening right now. So my strategy around all of this uncertainty has really been to, like, I'm not going to freak out until I know that I actually really have to freak out.
Yeah.
Like, because it doesn't serve anyone. It doesn't serve my organization. It doesn't serve the people who are working at Sappers.
Yeah.
So I've tried to be really...
It doesn't serve you as a human in your leadership role either.
Right. To name, like, I know it's really scary and frustrating, and it's probably inducing a lot of anxiety in a lot of folks right now, but, like, right now we're okay. And I'm gonna keep communicating with you when I know it's different. And you will be the first people to know. And so reassuring people in that way of, like, the very least of what I can offer you right now is sort of, like, transparency and timeliness.
Yeah.
And, you know, for fiscal year 26, which we're on the federal fiscal year.
So you just kicked it off?
Yeah, we're okay. We lost a little bit of funding, but we're okay. And so we will be for this fiscal year.
Yeah.
As long as...
Nothing changes.
As Don't long worry, as you not know, unpredictable. A few other things happen,
it's,
right?
Like, it's not unpredictable.
Like, the government
at all.
Stays open and the money keeps coming and and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But I think that's how I would sort of answer that.
Yeah.
I don't remember what the question was, but
you're doing great.
I think I answered it.
You're doing great. Was thriving. What was thriving?
Right. How are we thriving?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. And you know, again, just appreciation for the things that are beautiful and lovely and sweet in your life.
Yeah. Back to the gratitude.
Yeah.
I just want to, like, lift that up so much, in part because I think that's why so much feels uncertain right now. And there's so many people that's affecting their work, their mental health, their personal relationships. Like, that's, I just hear that there's, you know, newer data that's coming out that's reflecting that, you know, the uncertainty just kind of wears on you. I just think such, we talk about transparency and communication. And I would just name that, like, yes, and those help alleviate the uncertainty in the areas of which you can have some control to alleviate the uncertainty. Is like, there might be a lot of things we don't know, but you will always know as much as I know.
Yeah.
Is a level of certainty in an uncertain environment that just, like, I sometimes think of it as, like, I cannot tell you that the building is secure, that the roof is good, but I can make sure the ground that you are standing on feels like it's not constantly in motion. I can't do all of the things, but fundamentally we can set a foundation that feels, you know, solid enough to withstand all of the other uncertainty that we're facing. And transparency and good communication, thoughtful, frequent, regular communication, I think are imperative. But I would just say that, like, that is you taking away some of the uncertainty for your team.
I hope so.
Yeah. No, it's, I'm sorry you're facing that. I'm glad that you're not in the moment facing it.
Yeah.
This is a good time to tell people how they can support your work.
Yeah, exactly.
Say it, girl.
Yeah.
Sing your song.
I mean, here we are. We are coming up on end of year giving.
Mm-hmm.
So now's a great opportunity to keep Sappers in mind.
Yeah.
Website? And you can just go to our website, www.sappers.org, S-A-P-A-R-S. Mm-hmm. You can donate. There's a donate button. Right there. So it's easy to do.
And you can feel good about it.
And you can feel really good about it.
Yeah.
You know, because we're the only organization in this area serving survivors of sexual violence.
Yeah. Yeah, all ages. We've spent time talking about child abuse and child sexual violence as it relates to the centers, but you serve a whole spectrum of folks.
We do, yeah. We're the people that respond in the middle of the night when someone goes to the ER and says, I think I've just been sexually assaulted. Yeah. We get the phone call too, and we show up for that. You know, it's work that's not for everybody, but it's work that when people in the community need it, they're really glad we're here.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you hope you don't need it, right?
And I think that that's why sexual assault is just a thing that people don't want to talk about generally, right? But I think it's also important for people to know that it does happen in your community, and you want the services that we are able to offer to be available for the people in your community.
Any information you want to share about trends in our community as it relates to sexual assault, reports of sexual assault. I know that there was some fluctuations and some trends that we saw during the pandemic in relationships and, you know, violence and assault there. But I grew up in a really rural community, and my first experience kind of contextualizing and making sense of sexual assault, I was a child at the time, but I was one of the trusted folks in my class. I had a small class of like 32 students, super small town, and, you know, had pieced together the conversations that people had shared with me and realized that when I looked around my classroom, two-thirds of my class had some experience either with physical assault or sexual assault, and almost all of it was in their families' homes or personal environments, and nobody talked about it. Yeah. So like, you know, the narrative that, I don't know, 24 out of 32 12 to 13-year-old students had was, I need someone to tell because this doesn't happen to anyone. I can't trust anyone because no one talks about it and no one else knows and no one else experiences this. And then when you mathed it up, that was a really shared experience and everybody was alone in it. Has that changed? Meg, has that changed?
I mean, I think probably in our lifetimes it has, you know, the needle has moved a little bit, right? But, you know, I still think that's very much the experience of a survivor, especially a kid, but for anyone. And, you know, I just think we are a place where you can go and you can talk about those things to people who can hear them and people who are not going to do more harm after you've told. And that's really important, because I think oftentimes people say things in response to someone making a disclosure about sexual assault that are not very, they're not intended to be unhelpful, but they can be very unhelpful.
Yeah. And sometimes straight up damaging.
And I will also say that it's still very common in my experience whenever I tell somebody about what I do, right, is they make their disclosure about their own experience or someone they know almost every single time. And, you know, the main crime victimization survey that happens every 5 years bears out consistently 1 in 5 Mainers report on an anonymous survey that they've experienced a sexual assault in their lifetime. So that's 20% of our population, but that's the tip of the iceberg. Right? Because even on an anonymous survey, people aren't going to say that this happened to me. And I think people have a lot of experiences that they don't know how to define.
That. I think language until, is so, particularly when it's an anonymous survey.
Until they talk to somebody and somebody can say that's actually not okay for somebody to do that to you without your consent.
Yeah.
You know, because so many things happen in silence.
Yeah.
Even in the experience, no one's talking about it, right? Like, I think about my experience at Colby, where I was the Title IX coordinator, and so taking reports of people's experiences and then talking to the other party about what happened and seeing how so often it's because we don't teach people how to talk about sex in a good way. And so many things happen because people don't know how to talk about consent, right? And so normalizing, you know, I think if we could have our way, right? Like, we would have high quality, comprehensive sex education in all of our schools. Yeah. Like, that is primary prevention for sexual assault. And I think what's changed now is like, right, that environment has changed in not a good way. Right? In a way where people are saying, we don't want to talk about this. Like, that's not good.
I mean, it does feel like there was a peak in my own lifetime. Like, we went from a place of not talking about it. I don't know. I'm not as deeply in your field, obviously, as you are. But, you know, there was a lot of kind of public discourse.
Yes.
Related to the Me Too movement.
Yes.
That, like, there was viral, a lot of public spaces where folks were able to talk about it. But yeah, these last couple of years feels like a real retraction.
Yes.
Right? Like a shrinking of everything around what's able to be talked about and how it matters. And it's, so I'm a mom of four boys.
Yeah.
And when I think about what is my job as their mother, as their caring parent with them as young men, like, what do I teach them? Right. And so, like, you hit on some, you know, basic sex education, like, hey, condoms matter. And did, but from the very beginning, because of my own experiences, it was consent education.
Yep.
And then that got contextualized with a whole bunch of variety of things, whether it's like consenting to eat something that somebody has given you and not feeling like you have to eat something you don't want to eat or isn't healthy for you or you have an allergy to.
Right.
Like, consent is...
You can teach it in so many ways without ever talking about sex.
That.
I will say, here's a positive trend that I have noticed.
Yeah.
I have noticed in the past...
Finding joy. Meg Hatch, everybody.
Here we go. Here we go. So in the past, I don't know, maybe like 5 years or so, I have noticed that if I'm out with my dog, almost every single kid that I come across comes up to me and says, is it okay if I pet your dog?
Consent.
That's consent.
It's consent. Right?
And, like, that was a thing that, you know, kids weren't asking, you know, 20 years ago, I don't think. So, like, we're teaching kids consent about certain things, and it's very easily transferable when you get to having those conversations about safe sex.
Yeah.
It also has to be consensual sex.
Yeah.
But I think because we don't give people the tools to have those hard conversations with their kids, it's uncomfortable, right? Yeah. Like, for a lot of people, because, you know, they can't even talk about sex within their own partnerships, right?
Yeah.
And so how am I going to talk to my kid about this? And so recognizing that, like, Sappers is a, you could call our helpline, our 24/7 helpline, and we could help you. We could help you have that conversation with your kid, right?
Like, you're going to get so many phone calls. Give the number right now.
It's 1-800-871-7741.
We're going to circulate that in parenting.
Okay.
Circles.
Yeah.
Because, like, that's the thing is, parents, I have a real avant-garde approach to parenting, which I feel
avant-garde.
Like,
I like that. I like that.
It's been working out so far, but I would not call it traditional in any way, shape, or form. And so much informed by all my life experiences, but I just, when you're parenting, I find, like, parents that long relationships I have with parents who align with my parenting values, like, we might have different approaches, but like, overall, we have some basic fundamental agreements, and they're, like, bold and courageous, largely women. There's certainly some men parents that I have, but, like, some of my closest girlfriends, as we, you know, vetch about our parenting realities sometimes, these are really courageous women who have no problem talking about, you know, really kind of taboo or challenging subjects with their kids. And then I still find that there's some conversations where I'm like, but you didn't talk about that, or you didn't ask for your kid's consent before you X, Y, Z'd whatever.
Yeah.
And how important that is to modeling and reinforcing what the conversation is that you're teaching. And I just, for multiple generations, or every generation up to maybe this one, but we want our kids to learn it. We want them to experience the world in a better way, but no one has given us the tools.
Yeah.
As education and education systems and educational environments change for children, there is no second gen educational approach for the parents or grandparents who are at
parenting.
A higher and higher number being the primary caregiver
parenting
for children.
Kids.
Yeah, they're parenting. Yeah. There's no re-education for the adults.
Yeah, I mean, I think
about how to do
about how to do it.
So we'll just call you.
Yeah, and I think there's lots of great resources out there on the internet, but you have to know to, like, go and look for them.
Well, you have to know you want to look for them.
Right.
First, before you even know to search or why you would search it,
you got
to
have that conversation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as a parent who's, you know, put four kids through the public school system, I don't know on any given day what the curriculum is.
Right.
I know that they're, like, learning about maybe sex ed today or geology or government tomorrow.
And who's teaching it, right?
What
is
did
it
you
the
learn?
Gym teacher?
Right. And so, like, you just, I don't, and it's hard for parents. So I think there's a whole bit of, like, I bet they've got that covered,
you talked about that,
That's okay. The kid will let me know if I need to, like, rehash. And, so there's... you know, just saying.
Yeah, yeah. So as far as like trends go, I mean, I don't know that we've seen any like trends in particular, but like
I'd like to see a dropping trend. Can I make that my goal for like the world to give to you?
I mean, we stay pretty consistent, but, you know.
Yeah.
And I think probably over the last, you know, 20 years again, right? Mm-hmm. Like we've seen more people calling our helpline, more people reporting to the police, more people knowing that if you're sexually assaulted, you can go to the emergency department and have a sexual assault forensic exam done and get the care that you need. So I think we've seen an increase over time.
Thank you, Law and Order, SVU, for making some of those basic points
but
publicly
it's not,
accessible to everybody.
Yeah, and I don't think it's because more sexual assaults are happening, right? It's just because more people are more aware of the resources that are out there. And I think there are still moments in time, like the Me Too movement, where there's like a national movement to say, like, it's okay to talk about these things. And yet, you know, I think we still see, you know, I'm thinking about Christine Blasey Ford wrote a memoir about her experience pre and post Brett Kavanaugh. Mm-hmm. And, you know, 5 years later, when she's writing the book 5 years later, and her family is still experiencing like having to have a security detail.
Yeah.
And she still receives death threats.
Yeah.
So I also think there's sort of the other side of that where it's like, and people who come forward are still persecuted for telling their truth in really serious and dangerous ways.
Yeah. That. Thanks for the work you're doing.
Yeah.
Your whole team.
Yeah.
And all the teams across the state and the nation.
Yeah. So if you're looking for where to make your year of end of year donation.
Yeah.
Sappers needs your money.
Yeah, that.
And I know that there's a lot, right? Like, there's a lot of need. There's just a lot of need out there for a lot of things. And yes, we want people to be fed, right? Like, that seems like a real basic need.
Yeah.
And because we know a lot of people have had the experience.
Yeah.
Maybe that will encourage you to give a little over here, too.
Yeah. Well, and don't give a little because you need it. Give a little or a lot.
Give a lot, actually.
Right? Like, why are we talking about a little?
Give a lot. You just want to give us a lot. Like, that would be great.
Yeah, give a lot. But give a lot so that, God forbid, if you ever do need it, it's still there.
It's still there.
That's the trick that I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How's it going to benefit you? Because you never know. You never know when you might get that phone call
so
or
surprising.
Might have that experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love that. How do you guys at Sappers think about success and what like thriving for the organization looks like beyond some of the outputs, but in the context of thriving communities being successful related to sexual assault?
Yeah. I mean, I think I go back to like what we just talked about, right? Like if there was sort of like success, right, we would have high quality, comprehensive sex ed.
Yeah.
Starting in junior high, right?
Yeah.
Like starting in junior high. Yeah. I think that
can I say middle school?
Yeah,
I think middle school.
Yeah, I think there are things that you can talk about.
If we're gonna put it into the universe for it to become real,
yeah,
let's bring it down to 10 and 11 year olds.
Exactly.
That's the age I was having those conversations with my peers.
Right. Right. Realizing, that's when you start developmentally being curious about other people's bodies.
Yeah.
Like that's another brain thing. Like that's when it starts happening in your brain. So I think that would be success, you know, and then I just think that like, you know, we'd be able to meet every survivor's need, right? Because we can meet oftentimes some needs, but not all needs.
Yeah.
Recently, we've seen a bunch of people who are really in situations with unstable housing.
Yeah.
You know, and that's really challenging, and that's not a need that we can fill. And so trying to figure out like, where are the other resources around that?
Mm-hmm.
So I think if we, again, had enough unrestricted dollars that we could just meet people's needs.
Housing to make
right,
sure that
just meet people's needs, right? Mm-hmm. I think that would feel like success. And then I think like sort of organizationally, and I will say that Sappers is one of those organizations that has really just dedicated staff. We have a lot of people who've been around for 5, 10, 15, 25 years.
Yeah.
So I think organizationally, right, it's about sustainability and staff retention and people loving their work.
Yeah.
And showing up and feeling like I'm making a difference. You know, oftentimes people will tell stories like around the lunch table about like, and I know that it feels so good for advocates to hear, and we hear it all the time. Like, thank you so much for being here. It made such a big difference. And like, that's meaningful work.
Yeah. I love that vision of a thriving community. Can we do that? Yeah. Can we make that?
Yeah, like where people can like know how to navigate consensual sex.
Yeah.
Cause like sex is fun.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I'm a fan. I'm a big fan. But yeah, it's better when you know the rules and your partner are able to have conversations about
where people consent. Could experience that joy without shame.
Yeah.
You know, like
it's that. Well, and for so many people, myself included, first experience came with zero joy and lots of shame.
Same.
Yeah. Yeah. That's just the... Yeah, so I love that world. Can we make that the thriving world where all sex is consensual, enjoyable,
and fun,
shame-free? Yeah.
That sounds so good.
Yeah, let's make that happen.
All right.
If we're going to wave magic wands.
We're working on it.
If we're going to set visions into the world to become real, I say we go big or go home.
Yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh.
We always end with, I would say, a simple question. It's an easy question. It might not be simple in all reality. When you think about the opportunity to give advice to a younger version of yourself, or maybe someone else starting on their own journey, what is the thing that you would say? What advice would you give?
I would say don't be afraid to invite yourself to the party.
Say more, any party? Fun parties? Food parties?
Definitely fun parties. But I think about, like, this, for example.
Yeah.
Like, I just reached out to you and was like, hey, Shanna, I see you have a podcast. Can I be a guest?
Yeah.
I mean, I reached out to you all at the radio station. Like, hey, we have a golf tournament coming up. Can I come over and talk to you? And, like, I mean, and that's sort of what I did when I first came to this area because I'm not from... I'm from Maine, but not from here. But like, I just called up other executive directors and was like, hey, I'm new. Can I come over and learn from you? And it's so powerful, right? And like, I remember our first meeting too.
I
and
loved
like,
it.
I had met with like, I don't know, like two or three people before I met with you who were just kind of like real down on how awful everything was and how it's never going to get better. And so it was so refreshing to come in and meet Shanna, who was like, oh my God, let me tell you about all the exciting things that are happening in
this
area.
There's a lot of great.
And I walked out and I was like, okay, all right, okay.
Yeah.
We're going to be okay.
Yeah, it's not as bad as I might have thought. Yeah, man. Your ability to see clearly really depends on how clear the windshield is.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. It's real. Turns out my backyard is much more beautiful than I thought from my kitchen window because I had not washed the exterior of my kitchen window in 5 years. Really good at the front and side windows, but I somehow like the hose doesn't reach and yada, yada, yada. And, but like it really does matter how clear the vision is.
Yeah.
It's going to really relate to what you're able to see. And if you got a bunch of people painting mud.
Yeah.
It's
hard to see. Yeah.
There's a lot of great.
Yeah.
There's a lot, and you've found it. You've embraced it. You've helped contribute to it and expand on that lot of great. Yeah. So invite yourself to the party.
Yeah.
That's a really great advice, actually, that a lot of people need to hear. And maybe a couple people need to take differently.
Maybe not so much you, but you definitely.
But I think that's right. Mark, any questions or thoughts for Meg?
I just want to say our guests have been killing it with the final question lately.
I know. I'm going to have to compile a book of all of the responses to the advice to my younger self.
Or you can make a little like leadership book.
Yeah.
That would be so cute.
We need t-shirts too.
Oh, that's a good idea.
I love all this.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
Build, Lead, Thrive
the
logo.
Yeah.
The quote.
Just a quote.
Just a quote.
The attribution.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Killing it.
Oh, Meg, thank you for the work that you do for sharing more about it in your own leadership style and values. I think it's so great for people to hear that and to know the person behind the great work. I mean, you show up in public places, and I think folks get a sense of the work that you do, but I think the way that you do your work is as vital to the work that you do as to the actual work that you do. I think your ability to have real meaningful impact and sustain incredible people on your team is because of the stories and the values that you share today. So I appreciate you doing it so honestly and, you know, comfortably and with joy and humor. I always like, I love when we leave a recording session and my cheeks hurt and my stomach hurts and we've had some good laughs. Yeah. To our listeners, thanks for tuning in to Build, Lead, Thrive. Follow or subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Share this episode with someone, anyone who believes in building stronger leaders and a stronger Androscoggin County. We'll see you next time.
We're gonna get to know you. We're gonna talk it out. We're gonna get to know you and what you're all about. We're gonna get to know just what makes you feel alive. We're gonna get to know how you build, lead, and thrive.
Build, Lead, and Thrive. Voices of the Androscoggin.